My name is Gordon Thompson. I'm a DUI and criminal attorney in Phoenix. I've been practicing DUI and criminal law now for 36 years. As of the day I'm doing this, which is in February 2016. As a part of my practice, I regularly do jury trials, the vast majority of which are misdemeanor jury trials. And today's podcast discusses what is the jury trial process, because I have found over the years that my misdemeanor clients have little familiarity with the process unless they've been a juror, say, in another case. Rarely have they been a defendant in another case, and so they have little understanding of the process. And so at the beginning of the trial, before we actually begin, I do a description of the process, something like this. In Arizona, misdemeanor offenses are jury eligible, meaning they can be tried to a jury for two reasons. One is, if they were jury eligible when Arizona was a territory, Arizona became a state in 1912, but if it was a jury eligible offense in territorial days, that right is preserved under the Arizona Constitution. Two types of offenses that would include would be reckless driving. In addition to that would be, second category would be theft-related offenses such as theft or shoplifting. A second reason offense can be jury trial eligible as a misdemeanor is by statute, by state law. Driving under the influence cases are not jury eligible under the Arizona Constitution, but they are eligible by statute. Both of the DUI statutes for misdemeanors, driving the regular driving under the influence, 28-1381A, as well as the extreme charge, 28-1382A, make those charges, DUI charges, jury eligible. The vast majority of misdemeanors tried in Arizona as jury cases are for driving under the influence. The first order of business in a jury trial is both the state and defense have to announce they're ready to proceed with the trial. If the either is not, then the court would either entertain a motion to continue, or in some circumstances with the states not being ready, they would dismiss the case, and so that everybody has to be ready before, announce ready before the trial actually begins. It's incumbent upon the state to prosecutor to know they're ready or not, because if they announce ready and later it turns out that they were not, that could be an ethical problem for them, and so they've got to be careful about announcing ready when they conceivably are not. Assuming both parties announce ready, the first order of business is to pick a jury. In Arizona, misdemeanor charges are decided by a six-person jury. Usually there's an alternate, or sometimes in some courts there's a second alternate, two alternates. Now, to get to the jury of six people, what the court does is summons a number of prospective jurors. That varies by court. It could be, say, 100 people are summoned. Sometimes I've heard of courts summoning as many as 200 people, because many people do not obey a jury summons. If there's enough jurors, and I would say for a misdemeanor you need at least 15 on a panel of prospective jurors, and again it varies by court, there could be anywhere from 15 to 40 prospective jurors, assuming there are enough, then we begin the jury selection process. To do that, the court brings all of the prospective jurors into the courtroom and ask them a whole series of questions designed to see if they have strong feelings one way or another. And again, I'm going to describe this in the context of a DUI case. So questions that would make a difference in a DUI case could be something like, have you, family member, or close friend ever been charged with driving under the influence? Have you, a family member, or close friend ever been a victim of a incident in which it was alleged one of the drivers was driving under the influence? Do you have a strong moral objection to the use of alcohol, to the extent you think it'd be difficult to be fair and impartial? And the question which I think is perhaps the most important one, do you have strong feelings about the charge of driving under the influence, to the extent that you think it'd be difficult to be fair and impartial in a DUI case? The usual practice is if some of the jurors answer affirmatively to some of the questions, for example, say that they have been convicted of driving under the influence, then after the panel as a whole has been asked questions, then we bring back in individual jurors to ask them questions outside the presence of the other jurors. The thought would be that they may very well come up with more candid answers if they don't have a whole group of strangers listening to them. If somebody indicates that they could not be fair and impartial, then either a party, the state or the or me, can move to strike that person for cause, saying that they're not qualified because they're biased in some way. Strike them for cause. If the judge grants the motion to strike for cause, they're stricken. They're no longer part of the process. If the judge denies the motion, says no, that there is a basis to think they could be fair and impartial, then they stay in the jury panel. Now, out of the panel, let's assume that it's going to be a six-person jury with one alternate. I have the right, and so does the prosecutor, to remove two people from the jury panel for no legitimate reason. There are some limitations. You can't do it for racial reasons. But basically, we can say to our minds, there's something about the person we don't like, and so therefore we think they should be excluded. I have two peremptory challenges, as they're known as. So does the prosecutor, so that's four people there. So for most cases, to get to the ultimate jury, which would be six people, we need six plus one as an alternate. That's makes seven. Then four for the two peremptory challenges. So we would need 11 people out of the panel. If we don't have enough people on the panel to do that, unless the prosecutor waives one of their peremptory strikes, then we can't proceed. We don't have enough people to pick from. Now, in terms of the alternate, the way it's done, the alternate is not designated at the beginning of the trial. What happens is the court waits till essentially the case is over with, and then at random picks one person to be the alternate. Most common way to do that is to take a cup with seven pieces of paper with numbers 1 through 7 on it. The court just picks one out, and that's the alternate. Now, after the seven people have been picked, they're impaneled, put in the jury box, and they're sworn as jurors. That's important because once they've been sworn in, what's called jeopardy attaches, which means at that stage, the state can't dismiss the case. If it turned out that they're not ready after all in being able to produce their witnesses when they're required, the case gets dismissed with prejudice, which means it can't be prosecuted again. So that's another reason why the state has to be very careful about answering ready. After the jury, the seven people that will be on the case to listen to it are impaneled, the judge gives them preliminary instructions in which the judge describes basically what their procedure is going to be, to listen, how they're going to listen to the evidence, may or may not initially describe the standard beyond a reasonable doubt, may describe the elements of the offense or may not. That varies by judge. But at the very least, they have to go through a general description of what the trial process is, as well as what their role as jurors are. As a part of that, one of the, what I think is the most important instructions is that the court tells the prospective jurors that they have the right to ask questions. Back in December of 1994, the Arizona Supreme Court had a very logical thought. Juries decide cases, not judges, and certainly not lawyers, juries. Jurors do. So why shouldn't jurors have the right to ask questions just like anybody else? It makes perfect sense, and our Supreme Court gave jurors the right to ask questions. Until recently, I think we were unique in the union in doing that. Now I think there are several states to do it, but it's I think it's a very important right. Now, judges tend to want to de-emphasize that. In fact, one of the instructions that's commonly given is you're not encouraged to ask large numbers of questions, and keep in mind the lawyers know the case better than you or I. That's a common instruction a judge gives, but I frankly disagree with that. And as a part of my opening statement, I always like to emphasize that right. I do so for two reasons. One is because I want to create the impression that I have nothing to hide. Don't rely on us to ask questions. If you have a question, ask. I want all your questions asked. So it's, again, I'm creating the appearance that I don't want to hide anything, but also because it gives a general idea of what the jurors may be thinking of. Their questions are as I say, an indication of what their thoughts are, and it's good to know that so we can address those. But anyway, after the judge is given the initial instructions, then the prosecutor makes an opening statement briefly outlining the what they believe the facts will show, as well as they can give a brief outline of the law. After that, I can make an opening statement, or I can reserve it until the end of their case, or I can waive it. I never do that. I think it's important to make an opening statement, even if it's, from my perspective, not a particularly good case. Always make an opening statement because the jury expects you to, and it gives me a chance to get up there and say something with confidence, even though I may not have much of a defense. I still want to get up there and say something with confidence to show that exactly that. I'm still confident of our position. After that, the state proceeds with their witnesses. In a driving under the influence case, that would usually consist of an arresting officer, sometimes some other officers who assisted, possibly civilian witnesses, particularly if there's an accident. If there's a blood test, or sometimes with breath testing as well, it depends on prosecution agencies, they would have an expert witness to come in and testify the blood testing procedure or the how the breath testing machines were maintained. At the conclusion of the procedure is the prosecutor asks questions first, I then do cross-examination. If I get into a new area in terms of questioning, the prosecutor has the opportunity for redirect, go over the area that I ask questions about. Arizona is has what's called wide-open cross-examination, which means that any witness can be asked any question upon which they would have relevant testimony. Many states, a witness's testimony is limited to what they testified to on direct testimony. In the areas in which they testify, but Arizona doesn't do that. Arizona has, what we describe as wide open cross, which means you can be asked any question, even if it had nothing to do with what the witnesses testified on direct. They have to have relevant knowledge, but they can do it. For example, police officer can be asked questions about signs and symptoms of impairment that had nothing to do, or the absence thereof, that had nothing to do with what they testified to on direct. There's lots of areas that we can get into. Again, it's not just limited to the scope of what the prosecutor's questions were. At the end of the prosecution case, they will say they rest. I would then make a motion for directed verdict saying that there's insufficient evidence to have the case even go to the jury. That there really is no evidence against my client. Most of the time, those motions are denied. Judges are very reluctant to do that. Basically, if there's any evidence in the that's been presented that supports the state's case, then that's enough. But you make the motion anyway. After that, we can either present evidence or not present evidence. It depends on the case. If the defendant doesn't testify, what the judge does is instructs the jury that that's a right that they have and that they can't infer anything against the person for not testifying because that's a right, and they cannot let that affect the deliberations in any way. My feeling is with defendants in a driving under the influence case, they shouldn't testify unless they've got something important to say. If there's some bit of evidence, for example, something that directly contradicts the officer that only the defendant could testify to, then might consider having the client testify. But unless there's something important to have them testify to, I think it's always better not to. When you see the state's witnesses as a part of the prosecution case, you look at it and say, boy, this looks easy to testify, but it's not. It's easy to get tripped up, and what the jury doesn't realize that the police officers and the other state's witnesses that are connected with the police are trained on how to testify. So they make it look very natural, but it really isn't. And so even though a client can very well be testifying truthfully, they can get easily tripped up because they're not used to testifying. So you got to have a good reason, I think, to have your client testify. After deciding that, and we can wait until the very end of the case to decide that, we may present evidence, for example, in a blood case. where there was blood testing, I may present an expert witness to contradict the state's testimony or say that we got the blood retested and what the results of the retest are. Or there may be civilian witnesses who would testify that they were present during the incident, or maybe some other aspect of the case. So sometimes we would have civilians testify. But again, unless there's a pretty good reason, we don't like to put on witnesses, because any witness that's not a practiced witness, like a police officer or a police employee, can easily come back looking not that good, because jurors don't appreciate the fact that police witnesses are trained how to do that and civilians are not. In addition to getting back to the idea of wide open cross, I can put a witness on excuse me, to say they saw something, and the next thing you know, the prosecutor's asking them about signs and symptoms of impairment and what they would consider somebody to be impaired, something that they're really not familiar with, but if they have some knowledge, they're qualified to testify to that. So you have to be careful with wide open cross. At the end of the defense case, the prosecution has the opportunity to bring up what's called rebuttal, which means if there's anything we brought up for the first time as a part of our case, for example, an alibi that somebody wasn't present during the time of the trial, they can conceivably bring up a witness to contradict something we brought up for the first time as a part of our case. Rebuttal, though, is meant to be very limited. Prosecutors love to try to redo the whole case in rebuttal, but that's not what rebuttal is. It's something specifically that we can't brought up for the first time as a part of the defense case. If we didn't present any evidence, then there's nothing to rebut. But rebuttal is meant to be very limited. At the end of that, we again, backing up a little bit, I would have rested prior to rebuttal. And with or without rebuttal, then at the end of the evidence, the next step would be to instruct the jury, have the judge instruct the jury as to the law and procedure that are followed and decide the case. Then the prosecutor would make a first opening statement. I then make my opening statement, the prosecutor would make their first closing argument. I then make my closing argument, and then the prosecution has the right to make a second closing argument. They get to argue twice, and then after that, then the jury would go back and decide the case. Now, in terms of the judge's instructions, closing instructions, they would go through the elements of the offense, what constitutes driving under the influence, as well as what constitutes the extreme, if that's charged. Judge would have to describe the standard beyond a reasonable doubt and what that means for the jury. Basically, from my perspective, is the evidence must eliminate all real possibility the person is not guilty before a jury can come back with a verdict of guilty. And the judge would instruct them that they have to decide the case unanimously one way or another. Now, sometimes we try additional charges besides driving under the influence as a part of that happened within the context of the case, but it's not a jury-eligible offense. For example, excessive speeding, going 20 miles an hour over the speed limit, is a criminal charge, but it's not a jury-eligible offense, so the judge decides that alone. Also, if there are civil charges, for example, weaving or improper turn, those will be decided separately by the judge. After the closing arguments and the instructions, the judge then at random picks one person to be the alternate, and then the jury goes back to deliberate. They can take as long as they want, and what they have to do is be unanimous one way or another on all the charges presented. So, for example, if there's a driving under the influence charge as well as a .08 alcohol charge, they would have to decide each one separately, unanimously. A couple of possibilities are, one, they do exactly that and it comes back guilty. Second possibility is the one we want, is it comes back not guilty. Third possibility is they could decide one, say driving under the influence is guilty, but couldn't decide the .08 charge. If that's the case, then it's guilty of the driving under the influence. Conceivably, there could be another trial on just the .08 charge again. That's up to the prosecutors, but most of the time that doesn't happen. Another possibility is not guilty on, say, driving under the influence, hung or can't decide on the .08 charge. That case, then the prosecution might try the case again. That would depend on the agency. Now, if the charges, if at least one of the charges is guilty, for misdemeanors, we proceed immediately with the sentencing. For felonies, you have to get a pre-sentence report, but you don't need that for misdemeanors. So we proceed immediately with the sentencing. The judge sentences the person to whatever is the sentence they think is appropriate for the ones they were found guilty by the jury. In addition to that, the judge would then announce whether they found the person guilty or not guilty on any charges, for example, the excessive speed, which is not jury eligible, as well as any civil violations. If it's guilty of driving under the influence and there's at least a day in jail involved, unlike with felonies, you don't get sentenced, you don't go to jail immediately. The person is allowed to pick when they're going to surrender. So that is basically what the misdemeanor jury trial process is in the way I would describe it to one of my clients before we begin the case. If you have any questions about that, please feel free to call me. My office number is 602-467-3680, or send me an email to my email address of gordonthompsonattorney@gmail.com. Thank you.